If George Bowring gets a book like My Darling Nelly Gray as a result of writer's block, may we all get a dose of it. The first parliamentary poet laureate of Canada was having difficulty during a period of time in late 2005 while writing a novel, so he created a fascinating poetry writing project that came to include certain rules of composition during different months, 12 individual chapbooks, and some of the most inventive poetry being written. George Bowring is a quintessential writer with a range from poetry to fiction, essays, prose, and even westerns. His new book, My Darling Nelly Gray, is published by Talon Books, and he's our guest today. George, great to be able to talk to you in this way.
Yeah, well, it's great to get talked to.
The words writer's block are nowhere in your book, okay? The word that's used is difficulty.
Yeah.
But was it a block, or do you look at writing in such a way?
No, people have often talked. I don't know what a writer's block is. I don't understand how you can have one. Although I believe that it happens to people. But
Michael McClure said he gets writer's block 6 or 7 times a day.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. No. I always figure if something doesn't work, well, go try something else that you're working on, or that you had a note to go and work on. I have the opposite problem. I just haven't got enough time to write all the things that I have ideas to write about.
Yeah, the book represents the product of your first New Year's resolution.
Yeah, it was. What year was it? 2005. Yeah, 2005. Well, it was 2006 coming up.
Right.
Yeah.
So 2005 when the difficulty came up. In 2006.
So I'm writing a book at that time, a novel, and I'm sort of like less interested in it, or it's become kind of loosey-goosey or something like that. Eventually did write it, of course, and it's coming out this spring. But so I thought, well, New Year's is coming up, and I've never made a New Year's resolution, and I want something to keep me going writing, and this is the only chance. You can't start. You can't have, like, a Labor Day resolution, right? Or you can't start and say, I don't know, whatever, like, May Day. So New Year's coming, I said, okay, I will do that. I will write a poem every day. And then I said, why not write a poem every day for a month and then see what happens? And so I did for a month, and then it didn't have a particular mode of writing in it. Well, it kind of did. It was sort of like flowing from the way I wrote an earlier book. But anyway, there you go. It was a book, and it was about current things that were happening in the world. So that was a very loose restriction. Then I decided, okay, from now on, they're all going to have restraints of one sort or another. So, and sometimes the restraints were stanza forms. Sometimes they worked out to be other things that were referential. But so that the second one has very short poems in it. Like, it has 28 short poems because it's February, right? Or, yeah, is that right? 28? Yeah. 96? Yeah. And it has 28 short poems in it that carry on some of the sly references of the first one, or modify them, or something like that. But it really comes from a moment when my darling sweetheart Jean pulled my pants down in the kitchen on the first day.
The source of all great poetry.
That's right. Oh, you mean Jean, or getting your pants pulled down?
Well, we can talk about that. You know, the title refers to an old tune written about an enslaved person.
That's right, and it was a song. I didn't have a title for the whole book, like the 12 volumes. I was looking around for one, and there is a reference to the third poem or the fourth poem is one of those Joe Brainard poems, I Remember poems, and this was an I Remember one about my parents. And my father used to sing, he had a repertoire of about 6 songs, and the one that he sang the most commonly was I Wear My Pink Pajamas in the Summer When It's Hot, but he also used to sing a lot, My Darling Nelly Gray, which was a song written, it was written in Kentucky, and it was about it's in the voice of a male slave whose fiance has been sold to Georgia. I think it's Georgia, yeah. And where it says where they'll wear your life away. It's pretty sad, horrible. There are a few in the course of the 400 pages of the book. There are some criticisms of the great nation to Canada's south, and that one.
And we'll certainly get into that. Yeah,
but then you know what I found I had never heard anybody else sing that song other than my father. But I don't know if you noticed this, but the cover of the book. Well, now it's become a cliche ever since I did it. Now everybody's doing it. They're having a cover with a canoe on a lake, right? An empty canoe on a lake. This has a red canoe on it. It happens that there is, in one of the verses of My Darling Nellie Gray, a reference to a red canoe. And Carl Ziegler, the publisher, at that time my editor, found this out and put the red canoe on the cover and didn't say anything about it, right? Just in case anything. Nobody notices, and sure enough, nobody notices.
They don't notice a lot of stuff in your work. You know, you say in the introduction that you're a person with a habit of seeing the world through poetry.
Yeah. I guess, yeah, it's curious. Every time I look at something, I say, oh, for instance, we just went to Italy, and we went to Lyrici, and I thought, oh, yeah, Lyrici, that's where Shelley lived where he was trying to swim back to when he drowned, right? Or not swim back, that was Byron, where he was trying to sail back to when he drowned from Leghorn. And so every trip I go on has that context to it, and say, gee, did Shelley actually get that right? Or whatever. But that's just one example. I guess everything works that way. I really am interested in poetry. I think the world didn't exist until, except here's another question. I'm trying to explain to some guys in my writing group about misreading, because I claim that, I felt a little bit like Robert Croce doing so, but I claim that all reading is misreading, and that you can't possibly not misread something when you're reading it. And George Stanley wants to know what I'm talking about, so I'm sort of arguing with him about that. So you have a double question there. One is, like, you're looking at the whole world as it has been presented in verse, and then you realize that when you're reading it, it's a misreading anyway. Where, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's kind of the way things work, so deal with it, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we could talk briefly about each month as we go along, and maybe read some examples. We have a copy of the book?
I
think we have a copy of the book. Right over here. Yeah, there we go. In fact, this is an autographed copy, so be careful with it.
Who autographed it?
Some guy who likes red canoes, I understand.
I don't remember every what month everything is.
I have a little guide here, so we can help you.
That looks like Nate.
That's right. That's there you go.
God, he's got a gray beard. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's what happens if you're lucky. January, you say that you didn't really have an organizing principle, but an organizing principle does kind of appear. And one of the themes in the very first book is death. So that's a great way to start the year. You're very optimistic and thinking about the end.
Yeah. Well, if you're out in the garden and it's January and you look under your feet, that's what you got, right? So technically or thematically, it's supposed to be a rebirth, something new. Although people who organize the year properly had their New Year's in the spring. it's a kind of a fusion of death and life, January, that one and one builds on the other one, and that's a cliche that poetry loves to entangle itself in. There was a lot of death going on at that time, and it worked its way into the poem. I had my ears open to what was happening, and so Irving Layton, the poet, died that month. And there was a story about it in the paper, so it announced that it was coming into the poem, which is how I felt about everything. It wasn't that I took everything from headlines or anything, although that is what happens in a later volume, or a bit later a chapbook, but things that I had my ears open for. And then I realized, too, that there was a theme going on through the poem, through that part of the poem, that there was a developing argument, and the argument doesn't finish and before we get to the next book or the next book or the book after that, although it will become less obvious as you go along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about reading an example from January, from the first month?
Yeah, see, but how do I know How can it be an example when it's only a bridge between 12 is a bridge between 11 and 13?
Well, yeah, that's the
and also a bridge between 8 and 20.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have time to have you read the whole book, so people can get a taste. And of course, this also alludes to a process that you've been connected to for 50 years, and that's the serial poll.
Yeah.
How does that figure in? Is that just an innate part of the way you work?
This is clearly a serial poem, like from what I understand of a serial poem, the first January especially so. One of the most important things in a serial poem being that it's given to you rather than expressed out of you, right? That the poem announces where it's going to go after that. But I didn't go back, which Jack Spicer says you mustn't do. I didn't go back like when I wanted to write 14. I didn't riff back into like 10 or 8 or something like that and say, how can I develop that? If the writing remembers what was going on before that, then it can develop it. You can't go back and say, okay, now I got to fix that, right?
So it's really organic in that sense.
Yeah. Well, maybe organic. Yeah, in the sense of that I know you like organic.
The Duncan and Levertov thing.
Yeah, you and...
I put down, for the first month, I put down poems 1, 8, 10, and 16. So maybe, but you're free to, whatever you want to do is fine.
Well, there's a part of this number 6. This is one thing that was going on in the world at that time. The mother murmurs a quick prayer. The children, too terrified to scream, crowd her. The foreigners in shock costumes, oily rifles in their hands, smash everything with huge heels, shout in an unknown language, looking for boys to kill, leave blood and filth behind. They must have come from those high aircraft, they and their anger. As a bird hasteth to the snare and knoweth not that it is for his life, so these disguised youth unpin their future as ours, end the day washing oil from their bodies. So it's a kind of sympathy for... It's a kind of a peculiar poem because clearly, first we're getting the point of view of the mother who's terrified by these weird, huge, overly armed foreigners with goggles on their faces and horrible masks and everything smashing their house and trying to kill people. And then later on, an eye that has a sympathy to those kids who are, in Blakean terms, destroying their own souls. Well, they do that.
We're talking with George Bowring. He's the author of My Darling Nellie Gray, published by Talon Books. I'm Paul Nelson. February... started the official constraints, but you don't call them that. You call them baffles.
I used to call them baffles because I didn't know the word constraints. I didn't know that there was like a quote school of literature that referred to them as constraints, right? So I use the word constraints now, but I did use the word baffles, and I remember Doug Barber really liked that term. He got a hold of it and developed a thought about it. And I thought of baffles in the sense that, well, partly baffles are like you're. It's the word that means the opposite of itself, because if you have baffles in an auditorium, they're directing the sound in such a way that you can hear it better. Whereas to be baffled is usually like the opposite of that, right? Or it's very much unlike that. So that was kind of a neat word. But now I just use the word constraints now most of the time. I'll give you the sense of how a knot of light starts. A knot of light is the short one, and it has every... really, really short poems. Each one of them has four lines, except a few that have five. Four lines, and two stanzas. On the first day of Feb, you pulled my pants down in the kitchen. I'm not, bitching. I can gather myself together, given time. And then it takes time. I don't want to give a lecture on this, but anyway, time is what we're dealing with here. And I love, I'm very proud of things like, I'm a man with no pants, open to suggestion. Brilliant, I think.
Well, that's only half the poem, too.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. March was a page out of Joe Brainard's book, yeah. I remember, yeah. And that's also the anniversary of your father's death.
Yeah, the Ides of March. Well, he died on the 12th, and had his funeral on the 12th, or on the 15th. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I see an underline.
You do here. See some underlining. And feel an free to read that one if you don't. Okay. We can talk about it.
I think I realize this, I remember, and I remember books where, yeah, Joe Brainard admitted them, and then a bunch of other people started writing them too. And there was even one of the members of Ulipo wrote a book called, a series called I Don't Remember, or I forget which one it was. I think I remember my mother reaching over with her left hand and holding the steering wheel while my father rolled a cigarette and lit it. He must have been driving slowly on a straight stretch of road, though where we lived there weren't any really straight stretches. I am using adverbs to confuse any U.S. American readers. My mother liked to see how long she could grow a cigarette ash. At the kitchen sink, with the window open, she would be washing and drying, or more likely trying to take the peel off an apple all in one piece, and her cigarette would be more than half ash. We would hurry to her with an ashtray humorously, but she had the sink and perhaps thoughts of a personal record-length cigarette ash. There are so many tricks, I later learned, that you can do with a cigarette. Jeez, I like reading that.
And we don't like adverbs as the insinuation.
I hate adverbs, right? Yeah. They say, oh boy, that was real fast. Or in the case, you want something? No, I'm good. Yeah.
And you use the term U.S. American.
U.S. Americans, yeah. A lot of people are using that term now, including a lot of U.S. Americans.
It's true. We're with it. We understand what you're trying to say. Yeah. But for those who don't, why don't you explain?
Well, I don't know what to see. When I was a kid, we just called them Yankees because I lived close to the border. I don't like the fact that U.S. Americans refer to their country as America, right? Which strikes this a little bit like. But they also, if they win some sporting championship, they call them the world champions. It's like they don't think there's anything outside of the United States.
Well, there is Toronto in the Major League Baseball. Yeah.
But America designates everything between everything in the Western Hemisphere in the New World. So everything from the North Pole to the bottom of Argentina.
Tierra del Fuego.
Yeah, right. Tierra del Fuego.
What about number 17 in that particular one? Yeah.
Prime number.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember my mother and her pie crust. This is a woman who tried to have a cigarette-long cigarette ash, who tried to peel an apple all in one piece of peel. I'd see her, the pie held up on the fingertips and the thumb of her left hand, her right holding the long knife and trying to trim the circumference of the top crust in one long ribbon of dough. My father was so lucky. As my mother and I were discussing 2 weeks ago up in Canada on the phone, she did not like cherry pie with the usual pink and sour cherries, but rather fully ripe, almost black Bings. Not the type of store-bought cherry pie, but the wonderful Bing cherry pie that made all other cherry pies pale in comparison all my life through. I don't eat any pie now, but if I did, I might try to fulfill a life's ambition, and you know what that is.
And it's cherry time right now.
Yeah, it is. And you remember the Captain and the Kids, or the Cass and Jammer Kids, whatever they were called in your paper. She always used to, what's her name, used to always put a pie out on the windowsill to cool.
Not a good idea.
The kids would come walking from outside.
That's right. For a guy who wrote a book with the title At War with the U.S., The Constraint for April is not a shock. But it does come from someone deeply disappointed with the way the United States is going. You want to talk, and you know, constraint, sonnets, one of the oldest constraints there is. And, you know, another thing about the sonnets, what is a sonnet nowadays?
What is a sonnet? I still say a sonnet has 14 lines, although there are people who have written sonnets that have 11 lines, like Hopkins, for instance, and Duncan, for instance. I remember hearing the theory that who's that famous Canadian that's the greatest American writer about Ezra Pound? Anyway, what's his name? He said he thinks that this. He thinks
Egbert Foss? No.
No, what's his name? The guy that wrote. He writes on modern. Hugh Kenner.
Oh, Hugh. Right.
Hugh Kenner.
Right.
Yeah. He once. I remember we were at dinner with him one time, and he said he thinks that the sonnet was invented. He said, you know those the Romans, they were making these statues, and somebody would come and bang the arms off them, and so they're all be and the head. They'd bang the head and the arms off, and all that'd be left would be a torso. And then they said, "Hey, that might be a neat way to make statues, just torsos, right? Busts." Or sometimes maybe the torso and the head with the arms banged off, right? And so, yeah. He said he thinks that's the way the sonnet was invented, that these guys were writing these poems that all had eight-line stanzas. And some guy got distracted after only getting six lines of the second stanza done, and then looked at it and said, "Hey, wait a minute, maybe I should do that. 8 and 6, yeah, good idea. 14, there we go."
There you go. Or like the high bun, let's just knock off the bun part and make it a haiku and go with that.
Yeah. So these sonnets just have 14 lines. That's the only thing that makes them a sonnet. And half of them are, they're sort of found poems. Half of them are actual words of some document printed in the United States. And the other half are from photographs I've found of, so, I mean, I always thought I'd do American sentences, but somebody's already doing that. So I thought, okay, I'll do American pictures and American documents, like, yeah, for instance, the Declaration of Independence.
Number two is a good example of complete quotes, just all quotes, the whole poem.
Yeah.
Why don't you try that?
Yeah, okay. And yeah, it has quotation marks from the beginning to the end. "The American Society for the Defense of Tradition, Family, and Property was formed to resist in the realm of ideas the liberal, socialist, and communist trends of the times. Jesus was not homosexual, and his disciples were straight. Brazil says no to gun control. We denounce the use of fiction to spread error." "Something similar to what happens in communist countries is developing in San Francisco. The soldier had grown up and matured while the students were off to play. The followers of President Chavez make patent the link between the radical left and a satanic hatred." Of course, in that one, there's, I dropped a few sentences out, but these are all like sentences that were in that, whatever that piece of writing was that I found.
Yeah.
Oh, the American Society for the Defense of a Tradition, Family, and Property. That doesn't make a very good acronym.
Did May's constraint have something more than travel to do with it? You even note in the introduction how themes in May showed up in the 11 other months.
What's May?
There you go. You're going through May now. In fact, I think London Bridge would be. You got that bookmark there.
Oh yeah, the Montenegro, 1966. It's called.
Oh, that one there.
Yeah.
Do we miss London Bridge and the Tate? I guess that's still part of April. Is that part of the
no? Year? It comes along after.
I'm looking at these. No.
It comes.
Oh, that's right.
Here's
okay.
London, Chichester, London Bridge.
That's right.
Yeah. So what happened was the first trip I ever made overseas. Oh, no, first trip I ever made to Europe with my friend Tony in 1966. He was buying a new Volkswagen. So he said, "You want to come with me?" And I said, "Okay, as long as we go to Istanbul." And he said, "Okay, we'll go to Istanbul." So what he would do is, we were living in Calgary. He would buy a Volkswagen over in Germany, drive it around for several weeks in Europe, then have it shipped to Alberta, and it would cost less than if he'd bought it in Alberta.
People are catching on to this, I think. Smart people, because it's still happening.
It was brilliant. So we flew to Germany and went back to England for a little while, and then drove to Istanbul and back by way of, you know, Greece and etc. So it was my first visit ever to Europe. I was 30 years old. I'd never been there before.
Yeah.
Nowadays, kids go when they're 17.
At Tate?
Well, the London Bridge as well. I
London
really like.
Bridge. Okay. "We hide straight for Poet's Corner to stand over the bones of gone minstrels, be they for an age or for all time. I stamped my pretty boot over the head of Lord Tennyson, but wait, isn't he in the dirt of the Isle of Wight? No reply. At the National Gallery, I knelt in front of Rembrandt for 15 minutes. I was 30 years old. This was my first time in civilization. Then, outside, there are fewer things better than to eat an apple in the sunshine, throw the core into the Thames. That night, after ample dark beer, we walked over a bridge where Anselm wrote, 'Cuba see, Eliot no,' on a spatter of birdlime." That really happened. That was Anselm Hollow, the poet.
Yeah. And so the at least two or three references to T.S. Eliot in this manner. Yeah.
Oh yeah. There is.
What is it about Eliot that I mean, obviously the two schools of poetry, the New American Poetry and them, but it's more than that.
I was curious. Well, here's what happened. When I was in school, going to high school and college and so forth, they taught Eliot and they mentioned Pound, right? And so like the professors liked Eliot, didn't like Pound. So part of being a rebellious young poet is to go the opposite way on that, and first of all adopt not only Pound but William Carlos Williams as one's heroes, and then see how Williams saw Eliot as being the person who was holding back and screwing American poetry. So you say, okay, so you say, yeah, Williams is right, Eliot's bad, right? Then one time Robert Duncan said, you know, you ought to read Eliot. So I did, and I started teaching Eliot, and I got really interested. I thought, geez, what an interesting poet he is. Still holding in reserve a little thing in my head that said, well, if I'm, you know, if you look at the shelf to your right, you'll see there's piles and piles of Ezra Pound books, but there's no T.S. Eliot books. So still had the sense that Pound was the person who broke it open, who was important. Eliot was but Eliot was an interesting poet. But he was still...
Wasn't he writing with the sense that he always had to have some kind of outcome?
Yeah, that's true. That's a good way of putting it. And he knew... Yeah, he lived his poetry... He lived an allegorical life, in a sense, that if something surprised him, it probably wouldn't get into the poem.
Whereas you're different. Whereas you want to have that surprise, and you're talking about the essence of serial form as looking for that surprise and lack of ending.
That's right. But then you start looking for a prize, you're in trouble too.
Right.
So, well, a lot of people now, like there's a cliche goes around. This is, says, what you're looking for. I'm not looking for a destination. Life is not about a destination. It's about a travel or something.
A journey,
something like that, right? Yeah. So if you had to, you know, reduce it to something that somebody who sits around an airport reading those books that you see people reading in airports, that's what you'd say to them. But yeah. But Eliot, I found, I did learn why you should read Eliot.
But you still put him up.
He's
in fact,
not my guy.
In June, there's another shot.
Oh, is there?
I think it was either, I don't know if it was the on page 189.
Blake. Some answers. Oh, is this the one about do I dare to eat a peach and all that stuff?
Oh, was it? I've marked the William Carlos Williams and the Loreen Nedeker. I'm not sure. Maybe it's page 189. The Blake. I don't know if it was the Blake one. I forget exactly.
William Blake.
Well, why don't you read the Blake and we'll see. We take it from there.
Yeah, there's no Eliot in this one.
No.
No. What these do is, I've done this a number of times, take questions that show up in famous poetry and answer the questions. And, of course, they become sequential. They're not just individual ones. You see references back and forth to other ones, right? So this is William Blake. Did he who made the lamb make thee? The same breath of spring's being entered us and separated us, till we stood amazed, looking about, looking to see who started all this. Finally aware only of the need to move, to take this forest as dance partner, to cool the fire in each brain, to look for one another once again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, is it the breath of spring's being is a reference to the breath of autumn's being, which is a romantic poetry.
and you were talking about, you know, we get back to this notion of...
The whole sequence here is about wind and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Wind and air and all that, yeah.
You even hold Williams to task a little bit, still in June, for, looking for an end. I think that's the bookmark one. Oh, there's T.S. Eliot. We just passed T.S. Eliot. Yeah, that was right. Let me see. Right there's the T.S. Eliot poem,
Shall I part my hair behind? Well, just about everyone's behind is parted. If you have a hair behind, though, you might think about a depilatory or a wax job, especially if you expect any kind of sex life. The mermaids, for example, combing the white hair of the waves, perhaps parting it? Such sweet sorrow. No, don't part it. Shave it, then shove it.
See, this is what I'm talking about.
Talk to T.S. Eliot.
You know how hard it is to stop myself from laughing when you're reading that. But if you could go to the Williams, too, that'll continue our conversation. Williams. I think it's right there. There we go.
Oh, okay. A quatrain? Is that the end I envision? Or are you lost, having thought of an end? A waking dream starts you off just as well. No question about it. See what you see. Hear what you hear. Imagine punctuating a gift fallen into your half-awake lap. You are found every time, not knowing the power of your words to keep the end out of sight. Yeah, that's the last part is sort of a little stolen from Robert Croce's thing about desire and how you want to. It's like writing poems is like male sex, right? Like you want to get there, but you want to hold off a little bit, right?
Yeah, but this notion of being lost because he's searching for an end, that's really interesting.
Yeah. A waking dream starts you off just as well. No question about it, right? So I had to throw in the question thing about that so people can say, oh, question, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And on the page right after that is Laureen Niedecker, who comes up again later in the book.
Laureen Niedecker, there's a whole chapbook written for her. Can knowledge be conveyed that isn't felt? I've heard your answer to that in your clear-spoken poems. I've heard the loud birds over your cabin and seen the fish jumping out of the river. I don't think I learned anything. I felt what I'd call nice. Is that right? Yeah, I guess that's right. I felt what I'd call nice, though I'd been puking all day. You toiled your whole life in an America no one imagines. Knowledge is piled in city libraries and police stations. There's a popcorn can lid nailed above a hole to keep winter from mousing into your kitchen. You got that across. Yeah, I went to her. I got terribly carsick on the way to seeing her house, and I did. I threw up at the house, and I threw up at the library that had some...
Fort Atkinson.
Yeah. And I threw up at the museum. And then that night, I threw up at the baseball game.
Was it the cheese curds in Wisconsin? Was that what pushed you?
No, I was driven out on the highway to her place, and I was in the back of a car, and I got carsick, because that's what happens when I'm in the back of a car. And I just remained sick like that all day. And they had a big party for me at the Miller Brewery. And everybody went except me. I was just too sick to go to the party at the brewery.
And this is when you threw out the first ball.
Yeah, so I went to Miller Park, and I was sick as can be. And I actually got to throw out the first pitch. And then I managed to be well enough to go out and throw the first pitch. And it was a strike on the outside corner. And then I was going back to my seat, which was out in left field. And I said, well, you know, I'm in Milwaukee, and I haven't had a bratwurst. So you can't go to Milwaukee and not have a bratwurst, right? So
they even have little signs on their cars, brat on board. I don't know if you've seen those.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what that's about. That's right. Okay. So I had a bratwurst, and I threw up again.
Oh, well, that could have probably been.
At least I got to see the sausage race.
That might have been predicted. Now, and just in time, she comes with the cookies, and we're on July, where you're doing love poems in three lines of three words apiece.
Yeah.
And it's called Shall I Compare, the name of July.
It's three lines with three words apiece. But wait a minute. No. Yeah, it goes... I don't know what to call these. Is that sort of step-down line that William Carlos Williams...
I think that Ed Sanders called them indented triadic stanzas.
Hey, that sounds good. So it goes 1-3, 1-3, 1-3. 1-3, 1-3, 1-3. 1-3, 1-3, 1-3. Comes to 27, which is my favorite number. Yeah, which is 3 times 9. When, of course, is magic if you happen to be a baseball fan.
Well, why don't we pause here?
Yeah. Oh.